From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We now know that my story is not a unique one. Over the past 2 years, we have heard from many other people who have been kidnapped, unlawfully detained, tortured, and eventually released without being charged with any crime.
Maher Arar, the Canadian citizen who is the victim of extraordinary rendition, will speak with the journalist who first exposed the secret U.S. government program, Stephen Gray. His new book is Ghost Plane. But first, the FCC is reconsidering broadcast ownership rules. Today, a town hall meeting is being held in New York. 2 weeks ago, it was an FCC hearing in Los Angeles.
The airwaves belong to the people. And I hope you guys decide that the license that you give are a temporary license and they can be taken away when things are not working right.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At least 9 civilians have been killed in a NATO bombing of a southern village in Afghanistan. The attack occurred early Wednesday while the victims were asleep in their homes. This is eyewitness Wakil Ahmad.
Plane bombed their houses here. 16 people were killed, women, children, and men, and another 21 people wounded. After the bomb, the foreign soldiers came here and killed 2 residents.
NATO says it was aiming at Taliban hideouts. In Iraq, the number of U.S. troops killed this month is on pace to become the third highest of the Iraq invasion. 11 U.S. troops were killed around the country Wednesday, bringing this month's toll to 70. The killings are on track to reach 120. That would trail only 2 months in 2004, when the U.S. military was engaged in full-scale attacks on Najaf and Fallujah. This news comes as President Bush has admitted there may be a parallel between the wars in Iraq and Vietnam. In an interview with ABC News, the president was asked whether he agreed with the assessment the situation in Iraq is similar to the 1968 Tet Offensive, which is seen as a turning point in the Vietnam War. Bush said the comparison could be accurate because violence is on the rise and the U.S. is heading into an election. In other Iraq news, the Pentagon announced Wednesday it'll try 11 soldiers in 3 separate cases involving the deaths of Iraqi civilians. 4 soldiers will be tried for the rape and murder of 14-year-old Iraqi teenager Abir Qasim Hamza and the killing of her parents and 5-year-old sister in their home in Mahmoudia. The soldiers' names are Sergeant Paul Cortez, Specialist James Barker, and Privates First Class Jesse Spielman and Brian Howard. According to investigators, Specialist Barker testified he held Abir Qasim Hamza down while Cortez raped her. Barker also said he tried to rape her before she was shot by former soldier Stephen Green. Green will be tried in civilian court. Trials were also ordered Wednesday for the murder of Iraqis in Tikrit and Hamdaniya. Meanwhile, in Britain, a top military official has leveled criticism of the Iraq war for the second time in less than a week. On Tuesday, Brigadier Ed Butler, the outgoing head of British forces in Afghanistan, said the diversion of thousands of troops to Iraq had cost years of progress on the ground in Afghanistan. His comments come days after British military chief Richard Dannett said the foreign occupation of Iraq is worsening the situation on the ground and should come to an end. On Wednesday, Tony Blair dismissed the mounting calls for a change of course.
It is our policy to withdraw progressively from Iraq as the Iraqi forces are capable of taking on the security task. That is why it is important, when we are able to hand over to them, that we do so. Otherwise, of course, we are a provocation rather than a help to them.
Fingers, Campbell.
In media news, the executive editor of the New York Times has admitted he believes the American news media failed the public in the lead-up to the Iraq war. In a speech at the University of Michigan Monday, Bill Keller said, quote, "The American media let the country down in its reporting before the war." The New York Times was widely criticized for publishing a series of articles that uncritically adopted the Bush administration's argument that Saddam Hussein was pursuing weapons of mass destruction. In political news, a new poll shows public support for the Republican-controlled Congress is at its lowest level in 14 years. According to the NBC News Wall Street Journal survey, just 16% of Americans give Congress a favorable rating. For the first time ever, more than half of Americans now support Democratic control of Congress. Democratic pollster Peter Hart said the results show voters see Democrats as, quote, a marginally acceptable alternative. In Chile, former dictator Augusto Pinochet was questioned Wednesday for his role in the torture of political opponents at Villa Grimaldi, one of Chile's most notorious secret prisons. Prosecutors want to charge Pinochet with the torture and disappearance of at least three dozen people. Judge Alejandro Solis spoke after visiting Pinochet's home in Santiago.
We were in the home of General Augusto Pinochet to interrogate him. He is accused regarding 35 cases of kidnapping and people who were arrested and disappeared in the Villa Grimaldi, as well as the case of 23 people who charged they were tortured. The general voices the opinion with which we are all familiar. He insists that he is not responsible for these events and that he does not even know the circumstances or the names of the victims.
The former dictator Pinochet's interrogation comes days after Chilean President Michelle Bachelet visited Villa Grimaldi last week. Bachelet was imprisoned and tortured there more than 30 years ago under the Pinochet regime. The Bush administration's refusal to join the International Criminal Court is coming under criticism from the chief U.S. interpreter at the Nuremberg trials. Richard Sonnenfeld oversaw the translations during interrogations and questioning of several Nazi war criminals. He spoke Tuesday in New York.
I personally think that that is most regrettable because we took the leading part in pioneering and establishing world law, crimes against the peace, crimes against humanity in Nuremberg. And yet, when the only world court was established, we did not accede to it. Not very much.
And finally, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security is coming under criticism today for preventing a leading British Muslim from entering the United States. Kamal Helbawi, the 80-year-old founder of the Muslim Association of Britain, was scheduled to speak in New York today at a conference organized by the New York University Law School. But just minutes before his flight was to leave London Wednesday, U.S. officials forced Helbawi off the plane. Newsweek magazine reports the officials did not provide an explanation. Helbawi is well known as a leading Islamic scholar and European spokesperson for the Egypt-based Muslim Brotherhood. He's also a member of the Muslim Council of Britain, which works with the British government to encourage nonviolence in the Muslim community. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This evening, a town hall meeting on diversity and ownership of the media will be held here in New York. Federal Communications Commissioners Michael Copps and Jonathan Adelstein will be in attendance, as well as community leaders, media representatives, and other citizens concerned about media ownership. The FCC is currently reconsidering a number of broadcast ownership rules, including whether a single company should be able to own both a newspaper and television station in the same market. A new study conducted by the Media and Democracy Coalition has concluded the proposed FCC rule changes would reduce local news coverage and eliminate diverse voices and viewpoints. Mark Cooper is the research director of the Consumer Federation of America. His organization participated in the study that's being released today. He joins me in Washington, D.C. Here in New York, we're joined by Alex Nogales, the president of the National Hispanic Media Coalition. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mark Cooper, let's begin with you. Release the results of your survey here.
Well, even in the largest cities in America, such as Los Angeles and New York, the two you mentioned, we find that there are only a small number of newspapers that get most of the readers, and then there's a handful of TV stations. If you let those entities merge, which is the central rule at stake here, even in those big markets, they become dominated by a couple of firms. But we've also looked at smaller markets all across the country, literally from Alaska to Florida, Maine to California, Michigan to Texas. You look at the state capitals, which are important local policy arenas, right, and you'll find one dominant newspaper and a couple of TV stations. And so in those cities, what you end up with is almost a one-horse town where there's one dominant outlet. And Americans still rely predominantly for their local news and information about a school board election, about the police department. They rely predominantly on local TV stations and local newspapers. And so for the American public, who has actually become very much engaged on this issue, as these town hall meetings show and as the proceeding last time showed, for those people, they really do not want, they cannot tolerate this kind of dominance of their local media markets by a single corporation.
Mark Cooper, how does this fit in with the studies that the FCC squelched? Now an investigation underway, two of those studies that people within the FCC have somehow gotten out to the press.
Well, what those studies showed, and they contradicted Chairman Powell's belief that it didn't matter, those studies showed that when you allow consolidation of local media markets, when you allow conglomeration across different types of media, although they didn't study newspapers, you lose diversity, you lose localism, you get less local news, and you get less viewpoints. And of course, that is the central policy here, is to promote local information and local diversity. And so they did a series of studies. They really thought that if they did the research, it would support their proposed rule. And everything they touched, it's fascinating. Every time they try to do any analysis, it contradicted what they were trying to do. And that's why they trash canned those studies.
Just a few weeks ago, the FCC held a public hearing in Los Angeles focusing on media ownership. Julian Doe was among those who addressed the hearing. He's a member of New America Media, the largest collaboration of ethnic news organizations in the country.
About 10 years ago, Los Angeles by then was already one of the most diverse cities in America. Ethnic media programs on electronic media has been pretty dismal. Sure, there were Univision, Chemex, Channel 34, and Telemundo 52, and a number of Spanish radios. But the growing population of Asian communities like Chinese, Korean, Filipino, and the Middle Eastern communities has very limited media's presence. There has always been a hunger for news about local communities. But in a place like L.A., we are talking about what's happening, not just in a general general audience, but also in the African-American communities, what's happening in the Filipino communities, and Guatemalan community, and so forth. Unfortunately, we are not getting that. Adding more insult to the injuries, when big mainstream media decide to do stories on the Cambodian or the El Salvadorian communities, the stories tend to be about crimes or tragedies. Ethnic communities have been for years trying to engage mainstream medias about their communities and also as sources of insights for better reporting. Well, with media consolidations, the situation has become worse. Our frustrations, a number of ethnic groups have resorted to satellite programs. However, not all ethnic households could afford the cost of monthly fees, which often average about $50 to $100 a month. Today, I would say the situation for a major market like LA has somewhat improved, but for some, and not for the others. There are now five public access Spanish language TV such as Univision, Telemundo, KY, Azteca TV, and Televisa. Spanish language radio also has a big presence in LA, but KLOVE, KLAX, and KRCD, and so on. So Spanish language media is very well represented in LA. For other ethnic groups, KSCI Channel 18 has been a unique multicultural TV station which offer Koreans, Chinese, Vietnamese, and Filipino programming. Vietnamese programming has also limited access to airtime on KJLA Channel 44. There are also Chinese, Korean, and Vietnamese programs on multilingual radio network in Pasadena and Orange County. But all in all, given the fact that LA has the minority-majority demographic news program and content have not reflected that, this is not just about fairness, but also on the basis of providing comprehensive news about our society. About 2 years ago, we had a panel discussion between mainstream and ethnic medias on how do you cover the city like LA, where the population is so diverse. Oftentimes, to the extent of covering news stories among ethnic communities, large broadcast media tend to focus more on the sensational stories, like tragedies or crimes. The conclusion was that, sure, there is no single media entity today that could provide comprehensive news coverage about diverse cities. However, recent media consolidation has made the situation even worse. And all the panelists agreed that by extending adequate airtime to the growing diverse communities, needed local news would also be enhanced. While we are seeing great improvement for Spanish language media in certain Asian communities, there are groups such as the Middle Eastern communities and the Asian and Southeast Asian communities, like the Filipinos, whose number is nearly 300,000 in LA, had only half an hour or no zero airtime. The Thai, with 70,000, had no TV or radio airtime, and the Cambodians, 50,000, had only 2 hours but on cable. With limited time left, I would go straight directly to our recommendations that we would like to highlight our major points. One, FCC should look into programs to identify very underserved communities to assist them with more airtimes. Media consolidation does affect sustainability of many ethnic broadcast programs, as big media has the advantage of offering economy of scale on one stop for cheaper and more competitive ad rates. And lastly, although there are now many mainstream media broadcast networks offering multilingual programs, there is a big difference when the station is actually owned by a minority operator. It would give the minority broadcast operator a greater chance of being sustainable and also adequate resources to cover issues concerning ethnic communities that are often overlooked or cannot be covered well by large mainstream media. Thank you.
Thank you.
Julian Doe of New America Media speaking at the FCC hearing in Los Angeles. There were other people there, those who spoke at the hearing from the audience.
The airwaves belong to the people. And I hope you guys decide that the license that you give are a temporary license and they can be taken away when things are not working right. Just think about that. The airwaves are the people's and they are entrusted to the guys that are transmitting and then it will go away. The second thing is a cultural and educational endeavor, the media. And it's not more like a business. Those guys were talking the economy of the business. We cannot make business with it. We have to consolidate. If you cannot make business, get out of the business. Okay? The third thing, if you go to a newspaper stands and you see the difference from different state, every picture in the front page is the same one, just cropped differently. We don't want that to happen to our media.
In 1773, our founders began this country in part by taking an action and throwing a bunch of tea in the Boston Harbor. This was a reaction against a state-sponsored monopoly, the East India Trading Company. It's not just because this is what our country is about, is taking helping the powerless against the powerful, but it's also what works. California has had recent experience with letting the foxes rule the hen house when we allowed energy giants to take over the energy distribution in this country, in this state. And the people of California paid dearly for that. We only paid in money and brownouts. The thing that you're regulating, air, I mean, it sounds like the thing we need to breathe, and it is, but in fact, it's speech and it's discourse in this country. And if we allow the foxes to take over that, and it's already happened, and you're suggesting, I think, we should do it more. It's quite crazy. If you listen to the people here, there's no one that said, hey, media consolidation, that's great stuff. Let's do a lot more of it.
When I was growing up in Virginia, I didn't even know Latinos existed. Today, living in L.A., I'm well aware, not only that they exist, I'm well aware of their issues and their history. You've done a great job in turning my ignorance around through the media. I also wonder, though, where is the black American? I am a descendant of American slaves. Where's my image? Where are my people's stories? Where is our reality?
I think we all are in agreement that today, U.S. minorities are still underrepresented in the media at large. However, as ironic as it may sound, nowhere this is more true than in the U.S. Spanish TV networks like Univision and Telemundo. Contrary to public perception, for over 40 years, Univision and Telemundo have managed to fill their weekly primetime schedules not with shows that feature U.S. Hispanic actors, but with programs produced offshore in other countries in Latin America. Yes, we are invisible. Univision and Telemundo have gotten away with this precisely because It has never been subject, they have never been subject to corporate ownership rules and regulations by the FCC as a network. I urge the FCC to take a closer look at the Spanish networks and Univision and Telemundo and seek remedies to create and foster access and allow the full participation of U.S.-based actor, writers, and producers to create original programming in Spanish.
You can either have democracy or you can have wealth concentrated in the hands of a few. You cannot have both. That's not the paraphrase. In this case, the wealth refers to our airwaves. It's an incredible national treasure. And it seems to me the public interest should be balanced on the side of the 300 million of us rather than the oligarchs and plutarchs and billionaires you could hold in one hand. Especially when it comes to a time where our own administration is codifying torture and sanctioning the destruction of the writ of habeas corpus. Yeah. We need to have more voices in the media to speak about this rather than less.
Excerpts of a hearing held 2 weeks ago in Los Angeles by the FCC. When we come back from break, Alex Nogales will be joining us, president of the National Hispanic Media Coalition, as well as Mark Cooper to comment. Stay with us.
What you looking for? The same thing. It's a new thing. Check out this I bring. Uh-oh, the road below the level, cause I'm living low next to the base.
Come on!
Turn up the radio. They're claiming I'm a criminal. But now I wonder how. Some people never know. The enemy could be the friend guardian. I'm now a hooligan. I rock the party and clear all the madness. I'm not a racist. Preach to teach the
officer. Cause some they never had this.
Number one. Never wanna run about the gun. I wasn't licensed to have one. The minute they see me, fear me, I'm the epitome, a public enemy, used, abused, without clues, I refuse to blow a fuse, they even had it on the news.
Don't believe the hype, don't believe the hype, don't believe the hype.
Yes, was the start of my last jam, so here it is.
Public Enemy, Don't Believe the Hype, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting in over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica stations and NPR stations, on low-power FM stations, college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting in on our website at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also in Spanish in audio and transcript form, and radio stations around the continent are taking those headlines, and you are free to as well. As we talk about media consolidation today, we are joined by Mark Cooper, Research Director of the Consumer Federation of America in Washington. Here in New York, Alex Nogales, President of the National Hispanic Media Coalition, a part of the National Latino Media Council. Alex Nogales, as you listen to these voices from the first FCC hearing today at Kay Theater at Hunter College at 6 o'clock, there will be a town hall meeting on media. The critical points now in this new round of media consolidation consideration?
Well, the citizens have to talk, and we're all talking very strongly across the nation. We're all saying the same thing, and that is that we need to be included. And if we're not going to be included, we need to know why, and we need to make the people answerable that are the ones in charge of the FCC, that are the ones in charge of drafting laws that are going to impact all of us.
How does it specifically affect the Latino population of this country?
If we are absent or invisible from the airwaves, we will be treated as invisible people. And Latinos are not being treated very well across the nation right now, especially in English language and media. And what you're having is a high incidence of hate crimes against Latinos, because, you see, we're all being lumped into this undocumented category. And in this undocumented category, no one can tell the difference between one who is documented or undocumented. And so we're being blamed for all the ills of the United States. A little bit unfair, but that's a reality. And so we need to, in the local news, have ownership over those entities that program that, or we need to be included to, in fact, give the other side of the coin. say why we are here. Say what it is that is affecting our communities, the dynamics that are going on.
Mark Cooper, how does this round of media consolidation broadcast rules compare to what happened before?
Well, this time we're a lot better prepared in two respects, and I'm going to mention some research that we'll put in the record on Monday. One, there's a mass movement out there which grew out of the last round and is clearly in full battle array, so to speak, this time. People are turning up at these public meetings in huge numbers. Comments are flowing into the FCC. The second way we're more prepared is we've done a lot more research in advance. And actually, we've done some research on minority and gender diversity. And 3 points are absolutely clear in that research. One, in terms of racial, ethnic, gender diversity, the broadcast media, TV, is one of the worst performing areas of American life. The track record is absolutely miserable. You're talking about 1 or 2% of the stations being owned by representatives of minority groups and women. Second of all, the concentration of these media markets makes it more difficult for minority owners to have access and to gain a control of stations. A lot of the stations that were sold in the last 10 years were sold because they relaxed the rules once. So it makes it harder for us to achieve our goal of a more representative media space. And third, and it's very interesting, very clear, that minority owners serve their communities better. And these are hard statistical evidence. These are not just anecdotes. You've heard people say that. But this time, we've got that evidence. And it's very, very compelling evidence. The minority and gender issues are the most prominent issues. And the court actually said the FCC did a terrible job of addressing these issues last time. They try to avoid them this time. But those issues are front and center in this debate. And that's another major change from the last round.
And I thank you very much for all that research that has been done, Mark. Latinos are now engaged as never before. And we're engaged because of the fact that we knew that we were being excluded from ownership. We just didn't know to what extent. So when research comes out and it's empirical and everybody can see the same thing, that's when it gets good. Our community now has become so sophisticated that we've jumped upon this several years ago now. So now we're at the table with everyone else saying this is wrong and we need participation. So it's going to be very different than the last hearings.
And the difference when people are involved?
The difference when people are involved is that we have a voice, and we have a very loud voice. And remember that we are 15% of the U.S. population now. So it isn't like there's 3 Mexicans and 1 Puerto Rican involved. There's a lot of people involved.
Juan Gonzalez, co-host on Democracy Now!, columnist from the New York Daily News, will also be testifying today at Hunter College. This is open to the public?
It is open to the public. Everyone is welcome.
And your major points that you're going to make in your presentation?
I'm going to be the moderator. So I will be there with several other people that are going to be on those panels. And the main thing is going to be, how is it affecting us to be absent from the table? What are the statistics that tell us, do we have ownership? Are we participating at any level? And if not, why not? And we have to bring to the fore all those things that are keeping us from there. Media consolidation in Los Angeles, for instance, has done something that is very interesting. And that is that in two different instances, 2 television stations have gotten together and become one. They've become one. The anchors are different, but the reporters are one and the same. The camera people are one and the same. So all they did is cut away more jobs and given it the same news. Now, if you have a Los Angeles Times, a premier newspaper, that also is allowed to have these stations, it's going to be a double problem. Because as a former producer, I have to tell you, in Los Angeles, that's the first thing I did. I looked at the Los Angeles Times, and from it, I did my stories in public affairs. So tell me, it stands for a reason, then, if in fact this consolidation is going on the local level, to add a newspaper is just going to compound the problem.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. We will continue to follow this issue and follow the town hall meetings and the FCC hearings as well today. 2 of the 6 commissioners will be at this town hall meeting, Jonathan Adelstein and Michael Copps. Thank you. Thanks for being with us. Alex Nogales, president of the National Hispanic Media Coalition. Also, Mark Cooper, director of research, Consumer Federation of America. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. On Wednesday night, the Institute for Policy Studies presented its 30th annual Letelier Moffett Human Rights Awards in Washington, D.C. One of the main award winners, though, Maher Arar, was unable to attend. He remains on the U.S. no-fly list, even though his own government in Canada has publicly acknowledged he's an innocent man. Arar is the Canadian citizen who was abducted by U.S. officials at Kennedy Airport in New York in 2002, transported to a jail in Syria, where he was held for 10 months and 10 days in a cell that resembled a grave. He was beaten. He was tortured. He was forced to make a false confession about having ties to al-Qaeda. Eventually, he was released without charge. He became the first survivor of the U.S. government's secret extraordinary rendition program to speak out. In September, the Canadian government cleared his name and criticized the Bush administration for its actions. Well, at last night's awards ceremony, a video message from Maher Arar was shown.
Hello, my name is Maher Arar. Sorry I could not join you for today's ceremony. All CCR staff and I are humbled to have been chosen this year's recipient of the Letelier Moffett International Human Rights Award. This award means a tremendous amount to us. It means that there are still Americans out there who value our struggle for justice. It means that there are Americans out there who are truly concerned about the future of America. We now know that my story is not a unique one. Over the past 2 years, we have heard from many other people who have been kidnapped, unlawfully detained, tortured, and eventually released without being charged with any crime in any country. My nightmare began on September 26, 2002. I was transiting through New York Airport, JFK Airport, when they asked me to wait in a waiting area. I found that to be strange. Shortly after, some FBI officials came to see me, and they asked me whether I was willing to be interviewed. My first and immediate reaction was to ask for a lawyer, and I was surprised when they told me that I had no right to a lawyer because I was not an American citizen. Eventually, on October 8th, against my will, they took me out of my cell. They basically read a piece of document to me saying that we will be sending you to Syria. And when I complained, I said to them, I did explain to you that if I'm sent back, I will be tortured. And I remember the INS person flipped a couple of pages in this document to the end of this document and read to me a paragraph that I still remember until today. It's extremely shocking statement she made to me. She said something like, the INS is not the body or the agency that signed the Geneva Convention against torture. For me, what that really meant is, we will send you to torture and we don't care. After 12 hours of detention, unlawful detention in Jordan, I was eventually driven to Syria. And I just didn't want to believe that I was going to Syria. I always was hoping that someone, a miracle would happen. The Canadian government would intervene. A miracle would happen that would take me back to my country, Canada. I arrived in Syria that same day, at the end of the day, and I was able to confirm that I was, in fact, in Syria after my blindfold was removed and I was able to see the pictures of the Syrian president. My feeling then is I just wanted to kill myself because I knew what was coming. I knew that the American government, sent me there to be tortured.
Maher Arar, in a video message last night, awarded the Letelier Moffett Human Rights Award in Washington, D.C. by the Institute for Policy Studies. He was awarded by Vanessa Redgrave. You can turn to our interview with her that we did yesterday on Democracy Now! At our website, democracynow.org. And we'll put Maher Arar's full video statement on our website, democracynow.org, as well. Well, joining us right now in our Firehouse studio is the British journalist who helped expose the Bush administration's secret CIA rendition flights. Stephen Gray has just published a new book. It's called Ghost Plane, the true story of the CIA torture program. The book covers the case of Maher Arar as well as dozens of other men who've been disappeared by the CIA and U.S. military. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi.
How did you first learn about these renditions?
Well, funnily enough, I was first told about renditions by a man who became the head of the CIA, Porter Goss. He was then a congressman and head of the House Intelligence Committee. And he told me, I asked him whether they would find a way of capturing bin Laden. And he said, oh, this is called rendition. Do you know about this? And I said, no, I have not heard of it. He said, it's a way of bringing people to a kind of justice. And that really set me on the trail to uncover this whole network of prisoner detention in secret.
And so where did you go from there?
Well, when the Guantanamo Bay camp was opened up in Cuba and we saw all those images of those prisoners there, I asked about this and some people who are close to the CIA told me, look, this is the press release. This is what they want you to see. This is where they're taking the cameras. But you should know there's a much wider system of detention of camps around the world where people are being taken. And that really inspired me to try and, you know, get behind that and find out where they all were and what was happening to them. And in fact, you know, quite soon afterwards, well, a few months of, actually a year later, when Maher Arar was first released, he was one of the first victims of the rendition program to come out. And he described so compellingly what happened to him and how he was taken in this Gulfstream jet, this executive jet, which seemed so bizarre. He'd flown across the Atlantic from America to Syria. And describe the terrible torture that he faced. That also quite inspired me to sort of find out what happened to everyone else. And as you know, that use of these planes proved to be quite a clue as to how we could unlock this whole scandal.
Now, you actually were able to pinpoint the plane that Maher Arar was put on when he was sent to Syria?
That's right. I mean, I was able to find that actually the movements of these private jets, probably through some errors by the agency and others involved, were quite easy to track around the world. So I found out not only his plane, but a total of about 20 different planes used by the CIA and allied agencies to move people around the world. I got thousands of flight plans of these planes. What was important was you had people like Maher Arar and others coming out and making these statements of rendition. I was sent to Egypt, Morocco, Syria. And you wondered, you know, should you believe these people? They're accused of being terrorists, etc. You wanted to find out some way of verifying their statement. And the importance of these planes was it allowed us to confirm precisely that exactly what they said had happened was true.
So tell us, what was the company that owned the plane? What was the plane? How did it work?
Well, one of the main companies that has been used for these renditions is called Aero Contractors. It's a company based in North Carolina.
That's A-E-R-O?
That's right, yeah. And this is a company that is at the center of the CIA's aviation network. I was initially wondering whether it was just a normal private company that perhaps had a contract with the CIA. But as we dug into it more deeply, we discovered it actually was the CIA. And I eventually found some pilots who used to work there who described how they got their job working for Aero Contractors by being interviewed by the CIA. There was an advertisement. There were adverts from the CIA saying, you know, we need all these kind of people, including pilots. And they replied to those jobs. They got vetted by the CIA. They got put on what they called the box, the polygraph, in a hotel not far from the CIA's headquarters in Langley, Virginia. Finally, they were taken to Langley and provided with a series of cover identities, false aviation licenses, false credit cards, false driving licenses by the CIA. Funnily enough, actually, one of them involved said that he was given a form to sign when he joined the CIA saying, I will never claim I'm from the CIA, I'll never say I'm a CIA employee. He signed the form, but the CIA kept all the copies. But he knew who he was working for, and they all spent many years working with the CIA around the world. It's definitively a CIA operation.
And where did they fly Maher Arar out of from the New York area?
Yeah, he was flown out of the local airport here in New Jersey, Teterboro, picked up there. There was an FBI involvement in that particular operation because it came out of New York. the USS base. So it wasn't a sort of typical rendition. My understanding is the CIA took over. He was flown from Teterboro to John F. Kennedy, sorry, to Dulles Airport, where a new team took over. And then he was flown from there to via Rome in Italy, and then the plane landed in Jordan. At that point, I think the CIA took over. He was then taken, he was beaten in Jordan, and then he was driven over the border into Syria to this place you've mentioned, the Palestine branch. It's one of the worst interrogation centers in the world. And what I found out, in researching this book, that when he got there, he wasn't the only person that had been sent there by the United States. Up to seven other prisoners were sitting in these same cells about the sizes of graves, 3 foot wide, 6 foot wide. And up to seven of the prisoners there at the time had all been sent there by the United States.
Are they still there?
Well, some of them are. I mean, the whole story of this rendition program is that there are only a few people who've emerged to tell their stories, and so many others have disappeared completely. We don't know where they are. There's no accountability as to what's happened to them. There was one man connected with the Hamburg cell, probably a suspected terrorist who was sent there in December 2001. He's quite a big man. He couldn't even fit in the cell, and he's been held there for over a year in this tiny solitary cell, beaten and beaten constantly, and never brought to trial. So although people say that he's a man who's been involved in the 9/11 attacks, he was deliberately sent to a place where he couldn't be brought to trial, where we couldn't hear the evidence against him. So we don't know the truth about these allegations.
We're talking to Stephen Gray, an award-winning investigative journalist who's contributed to The New York Times, Newsweek, The Atlantic Monthly, many other publications. First exposed the rendition program back in 2004. His book is called Ghost Plane, the true story of the CIA torture program. We'll be back with him in a minute. Off the international radar, freedom drowns here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're continuing our conversation with Stephen Gray. Has authored Ghost Plane, the true story of the CIA torture program. You have documented in this book something like, 87 people who have been the victims of this program?
That's right, yeah.
Why is it called Extraordinary Rendition?
Well, it's extraordinary because of the way that it was transformed from a program that brought people back to justice in the United States to a public trial before a judge and jury to a program that took people to places where they wouldn't face such justice. So rendition itself has been around for a long time, in fact, since the 1880s, and has always been about, you know, snatching people where you wanted in the world. It's been legal in U.S. law, not perhaps in other countries, but in the 1990s, they started using it to send people to other countries. So it actually started under President Clinton. But the difference that occurred after September 11th was that it greatly expanded, but also it was used after that period to send people to places where there weren't even any charges against them. It was used to take people off the streets that were considered a threat, and was sent to countries where they had no connection at all. I mean, Meher Rawat, as you know, was a Canadian citizen who was sent to Syria We've got Egyptian citizens sent to Libya. We've got Ethiopian citizens sent to Morocco, really showing how it was used as a method of outsourcing of interrogation, not simply just to imprison people somewhere else.
Talk about the case of Mohamed Haider Zamar.
Right. Well, he was one of the key suspects from 9/11. In fact, when he was captured in Morocco in December of 2001. He was one of the first people in U.S. custody for the 9/11 attacks. And you would have thought that after those attacks, when the FBI and the other agencies were given the mission of finding those responsible, that he would have been held by the United States, brought to trial perhaps, questioned in New York. But in fact, he was sent to Syria. His interrogation was outsourced to Syria. And I got hold of a German intelligence report which specifically states how the U.S. organized that transfer to Syria. And what's more, there were trade-offs involved. They asked the Moroccan government, which was involved in that transfer, they asked the European Union not to criticize Morocco over human rights because of this transfer, because of Morocco's cooperation in the war on terror. So you see that behind this network of transfers and cooperation, there are trade-offs in the way that we deal. We soft glove some of the people that we would otherwise criticize over human rights.
Well, I mean, astoundingly, Syria itself. You had President Bush just a few weeks ago at the UN General Assembly calling Syria the crossroads for terrorism. Yet, behind the scenes, the U.S. is cooperating with Syria in having prisoners sent there to be tortured?
Well, I think the contradictions here have been so apparent that the relationship probably has deteriorated recently. But even going back to this period, busy period after 9/11, 2001, 2002, at that point, the State Department was saying very clearly that people would be tortured in Syria. The Syrian regime was put on the candidate list, if you like, of the axis of evil. It was stated very clearly this is a country condemned by George Bush for its legacy of torture and oppression. And at the same time, they were sending people to Syria. And the key thing was this was a covert operation. It was embarrassing. And it's still the most embarrassing country for the administration because they've talked about their agenda of spreading freedom and democracy in the Middle East. And yet the same people who are preventing that democracy from happening, the secret police of these countries, are on the other hand referred to as liaison partners in the war on terror, people we work with. The same people who are locking up dissidents who want to bring the kind of democracy that everyone, I think, in the United States would like to see in these countries.
Stephen Gray, last December, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said, the United States has not transported anyone and will not transport anyone to a country when we believe he will be tortured.
Well, it's not true. And I think she knows that. They have preserved the legal fiction when they've sent people to these countries by asking those countries, sometimes just verbally, to say that they won't be tortured, to say that they'll be given a fair treatment, they'll be brought to trial. But what was interesting in researching this book was I went back to some of the people involved in this rendition program from the earliest period, and they said quite categorically, some of these people, you know, believe that rendition is a good thing and they still defend it, but the one thing they're absolutely clear about is they told everyone concerned, they told the White House, they told the directors of the CIA, they told the State Department, that sending people to these countries would involve torture. They knew there would be torture involved. And all those promises that they got were a legal fiction. And everyone, one of the ambassadors, United States ambassadors to Egypt, told me there was a kind of nod-nod, wink-wink that went on. They knew perfectly well these people would be tortured. So when Condoleezza Rice says that they had credible promises these people wouldn't be tortured, she's not telling the truth.
Stephen Gray, right now there are investigations going on of people being kidnapped off the streets. For example, in Milan, the sheikh who was kidnapped. Can you talk about the prosecutors and was it two dozen CIA agents who were involved with this?
That's right. And they left a trail of clues behind them. They were quite surprising in the way they allowed themselves to be uncovered. What happened there was a man called Abu Omar. He was under investigation for involvement in terrorism, and the Italian prosecutor involved wanted to bring him to court. In fact, if he was still in Italy now, he would be in court. He would have been prosecuted in a normal way, in an open court. They were collecting evidence against him. But what happened instead was that in February of 2003, he was snatched off the streets and taken in a series of executive jets via Germany to a jail cell in Cairo, where he says he was severely tortured. He was released briefly, and he made a phone call back home to his family in Milan and explained what had happened to him, how he'd been kidnapped. And because Italian police were listening to that phone call, the story was revealed. He was quickly rearrested after making that call. Presumably the Egyptians were listening too. But that unlocked that whole scandal in Italy. And the Italian prosecutors, who believe that terrorists should be prosecuted in a court of law rather than being tortured in a jail cell in Egypt, have pursued this case absolutely vigorously. And there's going to be a trial very shortly of these CIA agents involved. There are arrest warrants for them. None of them have been caught. Perhaps they never will be. But there will be an open trial, perhaps held in their absence. It's going to take place in Italy and will expose further details of this whole operation.
What about Khaled al-Masri and the German investigation that's going on into that?
Well, this is a pretty live story. The German government have treated the rendition of their citizen, Khaled al-Masri, who was on holiday in Macedonia in Eastern Europe. He was picked up and flown to a CIA prison in Afghanistan, held for 5 months without any charges, without any accusations made against him, finally released without any compensation, without any apology, without any confirmation by the CIA that they carried out this act. He has returned to Germany and made the complaint to the German government. And what's interesting is the German government are treating that as a criminal offense, as a suspected kidnapping. And now they're looking to find those responsible. And it looks like in the coming weeks they're going to issue arrest warrants for some of the people they believe carried out that transfer from Macedonia into Afghanistan. I mean, it's one of those things. We've in order to investigate this story, I've had to try and trace some of the companies involved, some of the individuals, to try and prove what has been kept secret, the fact that the US government has been responsible for these transfers. And, you know, we wouldn't have had to do any of that. We wouldn't have had to dig into any of these CIA operations if the government had actually just come clean and said, yes, we're the ones that were responsible for this transfer. And if we made a mistake, we'll apologize. There's an old phrase, trust but verify. If you want to trust these people, you want to send prisoners to countries like Uzbekistan, for example, where they boil prisoners alive. They've been known to do that. I mean, I don't know how many people have been treated in that way, but it's a country run by an ex-communist who's known for that treatment. Well, if we're going to send people to that country, the least you can do is confirm that you've done that. Instead of taking part in a disappearance, take part in an open procedure where there's a chance of verifying how these people have been treated. But in fact, the whole program has been protected by secrecy, and it's kind of forced us to do all these investigations just to prove what's been going on.
We're talking to Stephen Gray. He's author of Ghost Plane. You make the argument in your book that the harsh treatment, that the torture, that the extraordinary renditions that are used to talk about fighting the war on terror is actually hurting the war on terror. How?
Yeah, it's not a point that I really make myself, but a point that is made to me by many of those involved. People, some of the most experienced people in fighting counterinsurgency around the world, military officers and CIA and former CIA operatives. It's hurting because I think you have to go back to what would people like Osama bin Laden like us to do. What do they want us to do? They want us to torture. They want us to take oppressive acts because that wins recruits to their causes. It's an old lesson of an old method of terrorists. Take a small minority extremist group. How do they win support? How do they turn themselves into a mass movement? The answer is cause a terrorist action, kill an innocent people, provoke an enormous reaction which rounds up people who are innocent, causes people to want to take revenge for what's happened to their families. And this is what's happened. There's been a massive reaction. There are people who've been turned into terrorists as a result of some of the repressive actions that have taken place. And rendition is one of those repressive actions.
Stephen Gray, I want to ask you about Venezuela. In your book, you write, the data exposed secret operations by the CIA around the world, even the presence of planes previously used by the CIA in Venezuela at the time as activists there were alleging the CIA was plotting a coup back in 2002.
Right. This is a story that needs further investigation, and I mention it because I think it's quite important to know what really happened there and whether the CIA was involved and other agencies in trying to prevent Chavez from taking power in Venezuela. What we do know is that there were allegations of a coup attempt against Chavez, and what's very interesting is to see that planes that have been used by the U.S. government, and for example, have appeared at Guantanamo Bay. It's not like ordinary planes that go and visit Guantanamo, and have been chartered for various other operations. In fact, you know, the same plane that took Meher Arar from John F. Kennedy to Syria, the man we've discussed who was tortured in Syria, that plane also turned up in Venezuela. And it's just interesting to see the dates of when these planes go to Venezuela at some pretty crucial moments. But as I say, this is a story that needs further investigation. I mention it because I think it's important that we find out what was going on there.
In the footnotes of your book, you say the first appearance of a possible CIA plane in Venezuela was March 4th, 2002, one day before the coup that temporarily ousted President Hugo Chavez. The possible CIA planes also returned to Venezuela on November 19th, 2002, December 6th, 2003, January 3rd, 2004, September 3rd, 2003, September 4th, 2003, November 9th, 2004. Now, doesn't Chavez know these planes are flying in?
I don't know. They don't come saying CIA on them. They come as private business jets that are coming into Venezuela. So I'm not sure he would know who was on board. It wasn't the actual day before the coup. It was the day before there was a plan signed to remove Chavez.
April,
yeah,
but.
Exactly. So it's a very interesting area. I've concentrated on looking at the role of these planes in rendition. But I've actually printed in the back of the book some of the flight logs of these planes around the world and a number of other operations they would have been involved in that would take some investigation.
Is the CIA or U.S. government still running secret prisons around the world?
It's still holding people in secret detention, and there are many people hidden in that system. I think that what's happened is, with the demands of the Supreme Court, that the U.S. follows the Geneva Conventions, which do provide for rights of prisoners wherever they're held, to be brought before a court of law, to be held according to civilized standards. They've shut down many of the facilities for now, although they've been given a new lease of life this week with new legislation. What's happened if people have been disappeared into foreign facilities, and you can look at some very key people. I mentioned the case of Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi, a very key supposed al-Qaeda operative, provided some of the false information under interrogation that was used as an argument by Colin Powell to take this country to war in Iraq. That happened after he was rendered to Egypt. He was brought back into U.S. custody, was held in Afghanistan, and now he's completely disappeared. So it's quite chilling, really, when the president stands up and says these jails are empty, because it makes you wonder, what have they done with everyone else? Where have they put them, you know? There are hundreds of people that were captured in Afghanistan, for example, that were not sent to Guantanamo, that were sent elsewhere, either held within Afghanistan or sent to other countries. And when they say the jails are empty, it's quite frightening because you think, well, where have they put all these people? And it's still quite a mystery.
Stephen Gray, we're going to have to leave it there. His book is called Ghost Plane, The True Story of the CIA Torture Program. And that does it for today's broadcast. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabdo Kadoush, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Frank Lopez, Aaron Mate, Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo, and Nick Marsilio are our engineers. Tonight, I'll be in Concord, Massachusetts, as we continue our Breaking the Sound Barrier tour at the Concord Festival of Authors Emerson Umbrella Center for the Arts at 40 Stowe Street, and that's at 7:30 tonight. Tomorrow in San Antonio, on Saturday, we'll be in California, Sunday in Phoenix. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.